We welcome Sharon Weaver as our speaker today. Sharon earned a master's degree in divinity at Vanderbilt University, and she has held work positions as a teacher, nonprofit worker, and college professor. Sharon currently operates a consulting company called Spiritual Care Providers. The title of Sharon's sermon is Readings from Sabbath by Wayne Muller, Hurling into the Eschaton. Let's welcome Sharon.
As always, it's good to be back with everyone and see new faces, and it's just good to be out and not have to worry about ice and snow and cold, and of course already we're worrying about the heat. I want to first do something today, and I'm so glad not everyone was here at the front row. Two chairs, and they're both for you, each of you. I'm going to read this today, and we're going to discuss in the second hour continued work on the Sabbath, which is, I've got about two more readings from the book I want to share, Finding Rest, Renewal, and Delight in Our Busy Lives by Wayne Muller. Sabbath meaning, rest. And the song, the last song we sang was just perfect and beautiful. Thank you, choir. Sometimes when you've been hurt or when you are frustrated with or feeling squeezed by something that is powerful in our society or in your life, it's hard to see it clearly. And it's hard just to observe and not let emotions and past hurts intervene. So the chairs are for you in the sense of, one, I want you to invite yourself to sit in either one you wish, to sit in as you are with all the emotions and the hurts and the frustration or the unanswered questions or the whatever attached to Christianity and religion in general. But particularly Christianity, okay? The other chair, I want you to sit in as an observer. This is your scientific hat coming on, if you will. You are documenting. And to document, you know, if you're going to try to do your very best to not bias, you just want to observe and not have the emotional baggage or the emotional weight of determining before things are finished as to what you think about. So I say that just because there's triggers. We start out with a verse, and this is, again, Wayne Muller. But I think you'll be pleasantly surprised, as I was, what he has to say. Hurling toward the Eschaton. Eschaton is the end times. It is not merely found in Christianity. Eschaton and eschatology is the study of, the theological study of, the end of time. There's hardly, and I don't know of any of the religions that I've studied, and certainly Muller talks about the same thing, that there's hardly any sort of form of thought, even philosophies, that don't have some understanding of the eschaton. Even if it's a non-eschaton, it's not an ending, but a recycling and a renewal, which can be problematic in itself. But let's read what he has to say, and then I'll talk briefly after that. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Ecclesiastes 1:9, he opens. During the time of Jesus, Palestine was a place of wonder and anticipation, filled with miracle workers and prophecies in a Masonic age. Messianic age. It was commonly believed in first century Palestine that the end of history must be near and that the Messiah would herald the coming of the Eschaton, the Greek term meaning the end time, eschaton. Into this atmosphere came Jesus, a wise and gifted teacher. When his followers listened to his parables and stories, they could not help but hear them in terms of prevailing messianic predictions. If Jesus was a messenger of the Spirit, if he was a child of the Creator, if he was divinely ordained and inspired, then he must be the Messiah who would signal the coming of the end time. Most of Jesus' followers could not help but understand his words, actions, and teaching in that eschatological context. Because of this, the disciples' own teaching took on a quality of desperate, imminent salvation. The scriptures and the epistles of early Christian apostles rang with exhortations to repent. The end is near. The time is soon coming when Jesus will return in his glory and judge the world. Many, including the Apostle Paul, were convinced they would still be alive when Jesus returned. Clearly, this did not happen. Neither did many other predictions by early church leaders of the imminence of the final kingdom of God as they understood it. They were not alone. History is riddled with people, groups, and religions who have predicted how history would end, usually in their favor, often when they were alive, and universally accompanied by the gleeful destruction of whomever they deemed their enemies. But this is a very patriarchal view of time, to believe that for as long as life has endured, time simply itself would choose to come to an apocalyptic culmination simply because we have now arrived. However, the failure of the messianic prophecies does not dissuade us from seeking the promised land, the perfect future, or the fountain of youth. In Western civilization, we continue to be obsessed with the eschatology. We still believe we are the harbingers of a golden age, aided and abetted by the breathtaking miracle of technology. We call our particular messianic eschatology progress. Progress is the road to the new and improved promised land. At the end of progress, we will all have peak efficiency, superior productivity, and an elevated standard of living. We will have thoroughly mastered nature in all its inherent problems. We will all live in a place and a time in which all will be well, all diseases cured, and all wars ended with a chicken in every pot, as was once said. We are on the glory road. We are hurling toward the eschaton. There is no time to rest because we are on a very important mission, to boldly go where no species has gone before. We never rest on our laurels. We never rest at all. Every moment is a necessary investment in the divinely ordained and completely unquestioned goal of progress. What we are building for the future is infinitely more important than whatever we have right now. The eschatology of progress is an inflated pyramid scheme where our riches exist always to be mined and harvested in the future. Through endless expanding markets, not here, not now, but there and later. There and later we will see the promised land. We will make the big score. Our ship will come in. We will get the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Our time will come. We will strike it rich. We'll hit the jackpot. We'll be on Easy Street. If the promised land is the good and perfect place, then where we are right now must be an imperfect place, a defective place. If the future is sacred, then the present is profane. Every day we are alive, every day we are not yet in paradise, is a problem. Our daily life is an obstacle in our way. It is another day short of the end time. Today, because it's not yet perfect, is always a bad. This means that we have to work hard and long and never rest because our main task is to get the hell out of here. We cannot rest because we are in ungodly territory. the land of suffering and tribulation. And the sooner we get into the good and perfect future, the only place where we will ever be truly happy and at peace, the better off we will all be. But there is no place to go. Every time we finally reach the future, it vanishes into the present. This perplexing tendency of the future to keep eluding us does not, of course, teach us to be more present, but rather to accelerate faster. We redouble our straining toward the future, never stopping to see where we are, never pausing to taste the fruits of our labor. Our true nourishment will come when we are successful, when we are rich, when we are saved, when it's our turn. The satisfaction and delight are forever just out of reach. So we despoil our nest. We ruin our air and soil because it's all dispendable. We will not be here long because here is no good. It is not where we are going. Where we are going is good and holy and free and pure and perfect, and it is not here, and we are on our way, and do not stop us, do not get in our way, or we will have to mow you down, kill you, ruin your country, burn down your village to save it. This, then, is the theology of progress. Only when we get to the end can we lie down in green pastures, led beside still waters, and allow our soul to be restored. This is the psalm we sing when people have died. This is the psalm we say for death, because in the world of progress, you do not rest in green pastures. You do not lie down by still waters. There's no time. Never in this life, only in the next. Only when we get to the promised land. But we must ask this question. What if we're not going anywhere? What if we are simply living and growing within an ever-deepening cycle of rhythms, perhaps getting wiser, and perhaps learning to be kind, and hopefully passing whatever we've learned to our children? What if our life, rough-hewn from the stuff of creation, orbits around a God who never ceases to create new beginnings? What if our life is simply a time when we're blessed with both sadness and joy, health and disease, courage and fear? All the while we work, pray, and love, knowing that the promised land we seek is already present in the very gift of life itself, the inestimable privilege of a human birth. What if this single human life itself is the jewel in the lotus, the treasure hidden in the field, the pearl of great price? What if all the way to heaven is heaven? Sabbath challenges the theology of progress by reminding us that we are already and always on sacred ground. The gifts of grace and delight are present and abundant. The time to live and love and give thanks and rest and delight is now. This moment. This day. Feel what heaven is like. Have a taste of eternity. Rest in the arms of the divine. We do not have miles to go before we sleep. The time to sleep, to rest, is now. We are already home. Now, I chose this because when we talk about the crazy busyness of life, I want us to understand sort of the playing field that we're on. Whether or not we adhere to it, whether or not we grew up in a Christian home or went to church as someone who was trying to figure out whether or not to become a Christian, it is the playing field in this nation that was developed and merged with, as he says, technology or progress, capitalism and democracy. We throw those in. And 33%, according to adherence.com, 31.5%, according to the Pew Research on Religion and Public Life, say that those percentages are related to the number of Christians in the world.
people who identify themselves as adherents to the Christian faith,
equaling roughly 2.1 billion people.
In the United States, according to Pew Research, their study on religion and public life, 78.4% identify themselves in the United States as Christian.
So there's still quite the overlay that we are dealing with this particular faith and its view of eschatology, end times. And so just as the Apostle Paul believed the end times were coming and that he would see them, other people and the faith itself has just kept moving it back a little bit, right? And understanding, well, not today, tomorrow, maybe tomorrow. But there is still that hope and expectation that the end times will come, Jesus will return, and all will be well for those who follow. Now, if we weren't Christian, according to the same resources, 21% of us in the world, 23.2% according to Pew Research, which is a little bit more recent, says that 1.5 billion of us identify as Islamic. That's the next largest group in the world of religious adherents. The good news for people that break out in hives, or at least makes us nervous when we think about religion, period, sometimes, is that secular, non-religious, agnostic, atheists, all put in together, represent 1.1 billion, or 16%, 16.3% respectively, which is the third largest group of adherents, or non-adherents. Or whatever you'd like to know. Rounding the corner is Hinduism, with 900 million people, followed closely by Chinese traditional, which I had to look up basically Confucianism and the Taoism, and Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism lumped over there. So already you start seeing, oh, well, are you a Buddhist or a Chinese Buddhist? And then you know, what kind of Buddhism? And Buddhism follows. Number 20 on the list, separate but still there, was the Universalists. Universalists, yay, UUs are there, 800,000. Separate. But then they made a note, we must confuse them. Made a note, a lot of people say they are, and they not necessarily joined, so we think it's like more of a philosophy. But there's Christians in there too, and some people identify as Buddhist and pagan, so it's like they just put us in there, but they don't know what to do with us, but that's okay. The purpose of that is to say, though, guess who owns the field? You know, guess who owns the playing field? And gets to kind of set the tone. It's still Christian, and if not, rounded up is Islam in the world. And both are rather rigid in what their definite beliefs are related to eschaton and how you should live. So, when we talk about stress, when we talk about that stress of, you know, we want to be ourselves, we want to relax, we want to rest. Why is it when we're in the world, we feel stressed? In part, it's because we're born into it. We're born into that needing to be saved, that needing to prep for the future that's not here. And we see that in popular culture, just as it has been. And sometimes it gets very damaging. Certainly the cults, we've seen Jim Jones, the Branch Davidians, the cults that tend to gravitate together and prepare seriously for the eschaton to come
And whether it's someone from space coming to visit and take them away, or it's just so bad here that we want to leave here and go immediately there, wherever there might be for the groups, typically heaven, then we'll speed the process, which is problematic to Christian theology anyway. But at one time, here in the States too, it was, and not just in the States, in the foundation of it, they preached and practiced and talked about the eschaton and the end times being so wonderful that people began to kill themselves to ready, you know, what if you think about it, if you're miserable and you're suffering and you're enslaved and or you're sick, why are you hanging around when the good stuff is coming? Problematic to speed it up. Problematic in the sense of what does that mean as he suggested for the world that we have? Why would you worry about the water and the air and cleaning up and recycling if it's going to go away? We're waiting for the apocalypse, the four horsemen, to ride in. We know it's going to, and if we could see signs of devastation and destruction, are we not assured that the end is even closer than it was? You see the rationale. You see that pervades, that gets in there. And so you have a problem with people who go, well, I'm sort of thinking it's the here and now, and I like the home I'm on. And though there's a lot of people that identify with, I am not of this world, there's a whole bunch of us that are like, well, I am. You're messing up my house. Pick up after yourself. You know, you may not like where you are. Well, you just run right on to wherever you're going to be, but I live here. And this is my space. A whole bunch of us feel that way. You know, like a third, or at least ranking in the thirds. And there's more Christianities in Christian adherents that are realizing the problems of focusing on. There's great problems that we have when we focus on that related to our own bodies, right? And we've seen this over and over. It's been such a problem that in Vanderbilt, there are studies, and not just in Vanderbilt, other divinity schools, about how to respect our bodies and theology of the body and the study of that. And many, many churches, they found that they are very overweight. One, because they all gather like food. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, Methodist, where I grew up, that was fifth Sunday dinners. But why would you take care of your body if it's really only a shell and you're moving on to something better? Right? Don't glorify in your body. It's just, this body is not me, according, you know, the rationale, thought processes of some. Now, to discard all of that is problematic. It is problematic. What do you tell someone then who is impoverished, who is suffering, someone who is sick, who is ill, someone who was born with less than a perfect body and struggles? Do you tell them? No, there is no future for that. This is what you got. This is it, buddy. Wherever you are in this world, and there's religions that do that, don't they? There's religions that try to give hope by saying, well, you know, if you live right, if you learn to deal with your suffering and live this life, then perhaps in the next one, you'll be less likely to suffer. Some will tell you, oh, well, that is because you did something bad in your former life, and now you're paying the cost for that. There's rationales. We try to rationalize rather than this is the now that I have. And this is what I will work with to find joy, to find rest, to find peace. Mueller talks about this because this book is a pushback. And what I'll be continuing to talk about is a pushback to the speed in which our world is working. He is not someone who suggests that we do not utilize the technology that we have, or to make, to do good things with what we have, but to slow down and realize that we must pause in that to enjoy, to reflect, to think about what we're doing. And so that's where I'm coming to encourage you to think about ways of taking time and reflecting on your own life, to breathe deeply. We already, if I can use their language, we already have the mechanisms to have peace. Our exhalations are reducing toxicities in our body, our inhalations bringing in the fresh breath of life. So I encourage you to live more, to think about living more in the moment and measuring those moments and by your own stick, not so much the time frames that we are caught up in, the holidays that you either join in or push against. To think about if you have a philosophy, if you have a religious view, what the end might mean in reflections of your daily life, and how that might not be healthy for you, for others around you, or even the earth that we inhabit. I'll read one more at the end. It's a blessing. Then we'll wrap it up and we'll talk more about this in the second hour. Blessed are heaven and earth, the sources of all life, who offer us the fruits of the vine. May we find this act of drinking, the grateful humility to accept all the sorrows and joys we've been given, and as we drink, may we find rest for our souls. Blessed are the sources of life that bring forth grain from the earth. Blessed is Mother Earth, who offers her body that we may be fed. May we be nourished, and may the strength we receive be used to heal ourselves, heal the earth, heal all the family of the earth. And this a blessing in a communion ceremony that is a non-religious specific ceremony. Thank you for your time today.